Warning: this episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing.
The following is a quote from an article in the Cincinnati Post published in 1910 by Dr. Ralph Reed, well-known insanity expert. Certain facts in regard to these murders and assaults stand out clearly. First, they were all committed in the same neighborhood. Second, there is a strange lack of motive, either of robbery or criminal assault. Third, they are all characterized by an excessive and motiveless brutality. Fourth, they have followed each other at fairly regular intervals. Fifth, no trace has been found of the criminal. This article came out after the fifth murder in the Cumminsville neighborhood of Cincinnati since 1904. Murders that appear to be committed by the same killer, who was known as the Cumminsville Ripper. And the area gained such notoriety that it was called the Murder Zone. This is a study of strange. Welcome back to the show. I am your host, Michael May. I first came across the story of the Cumminsville Ripper while researching a different serial killer, the Dayton Strangler. Some people think these are the same person, and I'll dive into that later in the episode. These murders occurred in an area of growing industry, along with multiple busy railroad lines and a streetcar line. The population of Cumminsville was roughly 4,600 in 1900, which included many German immigrants and African American families. What I'll do is follow the narrative pieces of each murder chronologically and explain the conflicting details from early reports and examine all of these various attacks and suspects. So let's dive into it. First, context and history. By the early 20th century, Cumminsville had grown from a rural village into a working-class suburb. The area was annexed into Cincinnati in 1873 and soon developed a bustling commercial district known as Knowlton's Corner. It's important to understand the role of railroads in Cumminsville, and it relates to all of these cases. They dominated the landscape, and they were the primary mode of transportation. Cars had yet to become the common method of getting around. The Baltimore and Ohio, Cincinnati, Hamilton, and Dayton rail lines all came through the neighborhood, as well as the Cincinnati Street Railway lines. Altogether, they carried nearly 100 million passengers per year. Cumminsville was nicknamed Happy Valley because it had a lot of saloons and clubs. It also had a Lover's Lane, which wasn't the romantic, cute notion of a Lover's Lane that you might think of when you hear that name. It was actually more of a red light district. It was also nicknamed, conversely, Helltown because it was thought to have a lot of crime. From what I can gather, newspapers were very sensational, especially around these murders, and it seems like crime wasn't as bad as they were making it sound. Women would travel alone at night on trains. People would walk to and from work and to go out and hang out with friends. And I just wanted to make that clear because when you hear the nickname Helltown, you might imagine this like Whitechapel of the 1880s in London with Jack the Ripper. And it wasn't like that. It was a much nicer, safer neighborhood than that, even though, of course, it had some issues. On the night of April 30th, 1904, Mary McDonald, who's reportedly 32 years old at the time, was visiting with her friends in Cumminsville. Mary's story is the one with the most conflicting information in this saga. So because details are important, some accounts claim that she was visiting her sister and her brother-in-law, the Stagmans, John Stagman being the brother-in-law. It's more likely that this is the Stagaman family. Ida, maiden named Kinney, and her husband Charles Stagaman. Newspapers at the time do make the correction to Charles Stagaman from John Stagman, and from what I can gather from Ancestry and other newspaper accounts, they were Mary's friends, not her sister and brother-in-law. However, if anybody has evidence out there to point to a different conclusion, please let me know. Send me a message, astudyofstrange@gmail.com. So now that I have that clarified, Mary had been drinking beer with Ida when Charles arrived home that evening. They all three sat down and they drank together until 10:15. Charles was going to walk Mary to the streetcar and mentioned, "I'll take you because I'm going to Schuler's Saloon." We don't know when, but at some point along the way, Mary decides to join Charles for more libations. To quote from the Cincinnati Enquirer, "Stagaman said they walked to Schuler's and had two drinks of whiskey there. Then they went to John Wagner's saloon on Spring Grove Avenue at 10:45 o'clock. They had two drinks of whiskey there and then returned to Schuler's at 11 o'clock. There they drank lemon soda, a whiskey apiece, and at 1:45 they went out." And Stagaman says that he pointed the woman to College Hill and Main Street car for the city. Mary would get off of that streetcar just a few blocks later, and we don't know why. At 2:05 a.m., the engineer on the number 9 train saw Mary McDonald. She was standing near the tracks along Mill Creek, leaning on a telegraph pole, and she appeared drunk. An engineer returning on the same train just a few hours later discovered Mary McDonald lying along the tracks. Her leg had been severed by the train, and the engine screeched to a stop, and the engineer immediately called authorities. Surprisingly, she appeared to be alive, and in the hospital, she couldn't explain what happened to her before she ended up passing away soon after arriving. There are conflicting reports about what she actually said in her dying moments, and most of those quotes you may come across to me seem completely fabricated and or embellished for newspapers and to sell magazines and things. In reality, Mary was delirious and hallucinating before she succumbed to her wounds. The initial theory was that she died in a drunken stupor, falling on the tracks before getting hit by a train, but she had a prominent bruise behind her ear that suggested that she had been attacked, hit with a blunt object, and her money had been stolen, though there is debate about how much cash she actually had on her person. Mary McDonald was the first known victim of the Cumminsville Ripper. Charles Stagaman, rightly so, was a person of interest, and it didn't help his case that he made a lot of inconsistent statements to the press and police. However, he admitted that he was under the influence of alcohol. They obviously had been drinking a lot that night, and he didn't remember everything, particularly the times. He was eventually dismissed as a suspect. Then on September 30th of 1904, a Cumminsville woman, Mrs. Wheeler, was out walking with her sister when they noticed a man following them. Block after block, this guy was eerily trailing them, watching. They hurried back to Mrs. Wheeler's home, and in one newspaper account, Mrs. Wheeler was quoted as screaming and running from the man until she was inside. After they were safely in the home, the man stuck around for a little while outside before walking away towards the train tracks and disappearing in the direction of Lover's Lane. The women described the man as having a hand in his pocket, as if he was hiding a weapon of some sort, and was either of mixed race or white. But out of all the details that stand out, the man's slouch hat was the easiest to see and the most prominent detail. What's interesting about this is just a few weeks prior, though it wasn't reported at the time of Mrs. Wheeler's interaction with a slouch hat man, is that a Josephine Clousing was attacked in Cumminsville. She was crossing one of the railroad tracks at about 7:30 p.m. when she was suddenly attacked, allegedly a man saying he'd kill her as he hit her. Luckily, two friends of hers were nearby and happened to scare away the attacker just with their presence, and the man had taken Josephine's purse and ran away. To clarify, each of these attacks comes with their own inconsistencies and reports. As an example, Clausing sometimes is noted as having been hit with the blunt side of an axe, and it wasn't friends that found her, it was actually a group of men. What is important is the details of the attack itself, like getting hit and having her purse stolen. Those are not inconsistent. Those are very, very specific. And the mention of the man who attacked Clausing was also very specific. He was wearing a slouch hat. Shortly after these terrifying events, in October of 1904, Louise Lulu Mueller, aged 17 or 18, depending upon the source, was listening and visiting a socialist speaker at Knowlton's Corner. Multiple witnesses saw her there before she left, and she was not seen again until early on the 2nd of October, 1904, when a young boy discovered her body off of Lover's Lane. Her skull had been crushed, her throat had been slit, one eye had been injured, and initially authorities again speculated that she had been hit by a train, but it quickly became clear that she was murdered. The isolation of Fergus Street, where she was found, and the brutality of her injuries made it clear that this was indeed a killer. Police soon arrested Theodore Salmon and William Wilson, two men who had been drinking with Lulu the night before, but they had solid alibis that were confirmed. And Lulu's boyfriend, or lover, as one of the newspapers labeled him, Frank Eastman, was also questioned, but not charged. Here's a quote from the Cincinnati Inquirer, published on October 3rd, the day after her body was discovered. "Indefatigable but unsuccessful efforts were made by the police yesterday to penetrate the mystery which attaches to the murder of pretty Louise Mueller, the shop girl whose mutilated body was found early Saturday morning, lying in the weeds in Lover's Lane. Not the slightest clue has been obtained to the identity of the man to whose powerful blows the weak and defenseless girl succumbed. All doubts to her death being due to foul play were cleared away yesterday. The theory that she was struck by a passing train on the CH&D Railroad and then crawled to the spot where her corpse was found were dismissed. The weapon with which the murder was done has not been found. The blood spots which were found on the path leading from the railroad tracks were made as the life fluid of the girl dripped from the weapon which the murderer carried from the scene of his crime." The brutal nature of Mueller's death and the lack of arrests led newspapers to link her case to Mary McDonald's, and the idea that a serial killer was on the loose took hold. And then about a month later, on November 2nd, 1904, Alma Steinigweg, also sometimes called Steinway, was an 18-year-old telephone operator and choir singer. She worked at the Park Exchange on Knowlton's Corner. She left work around 9 p.m., boarded a streetcar, and received a transfer ticket to switch to Winton Road. Conductor Frank Limley remembered a stout, bearded man leaving the car with her. Alma never boarded the second car. She had been at the Winton Road and Spring Grove waiting room when an attack occurred. Her body was found the following morning, November 3rd, in a vacant lot near the Spring Grove Cemetery in Mill Creek around 10 a.m. Her head had been smashed with a blunt instrument, some teeth were missing, and she clutched her streetcar transfer ticket in her hand. And there was also a blood-stained glove that was discovered nearby. A trail of blood and large footprints indicated she was dragged from the street to the field, down an embankment, and carried through an opening in a fence. This is a difficult journey for the killer. The reason for undertaking that difficult journey, for dragging and carrying Alma this distance and risking being caught doing so, was that Alma is the only confirmed victim to be sexually assaulted. A paper bundle containing women's shoes was found near her hat, so this is likely a package that she was carrying with her, and detectives believe that she was killed by a blunt club, similar to the other victims. The conductor, Limley, that had seen Alma and saw a stout gentleman with her, it turned out to be a false memory because there were actually two men on the train with Alma that night. They were locals, people knew them, and they had actually walked away from Alma when they got off the train. They went in a different direction while Alma went to the waiting room to wait for her connecting train. This murder generated more panic. The Park Telephone Exchange offered a reward for information, and this is when newspapers began using the term Cumminsville Ripper, Jack the Ripper having only been a few decades prior, so it was very fresh on everybody's mind. And following Steinway's murder, several more women were attacked around the same area, including Dorothy Hannaford, who was grabbed waiting for a train but was able to escape, Mrs. Unkebeck, and Mrs. Hagerdorn, who beat off the attacker by striking him across the face, the Weimer sisters and Mamie Roddy, who were attacked near Spring Grove Cemetery and fought him until he fled, and Josephine Hewitt, who actually pulled a revolver and fired at the guy that was attacking her. He tried to grab her by the throat. She did not hit him. He was able to get away. But all survivors described a short, heavy-set man wearing a slouch hat. At the conclusion of 1904, the attacks and murders seemed to have stopped. The city returned to a new normal, and that was until New Year's Eve, 1909, when Anna Lloyd, who was between the ages of 36 and 42, worked as a secretary and business manager for the Wyberg and Hanna Lumber plant. On New Year's Eve, she finished work around 6 p.m., and she chose not to walk home with her co-workers. Some newspaper reports say that she was fighting with her co-workers. I don't know if that's true or not, but she walked alone. A streetcar conductor later reported that he saw a woman struggling with two men near the lumberyard. Early on January 1st, 1910, her body was found in a ditch near the CH&D tracks by Hopple Street. Her throat had been cut, her face was beaten, and she had multiple skull fractures. She had been gagged and dragged into a secluded spot. Her satchel was later found a mile away, and the money was missing. Police arrested three men, Henry Cook, a butcher who was seen near the scene, George Lewis, a fireman, and James Fields. Witness Tilly Krebs claimed that she saw Cook and another man leaving the area. He was arrested and his bond was set at $1,000. Lewis was eventually released when officials confirmed that he was incarcerated elsewhere at the time of the attack. Fields was likely released. And Fields, he was an African-American man, and it was likely he was picked up just because of sort of racist suspicions. And the murder immediately made everyone think of the horror of 1904. The city council offered a $2,500 reward for the killer, and Wyberg and Hanna, the company that she worked for, offered another $5,000 reward. Rumors of racial violence were circulating Cumminsville at the time, and it wasn't pretty. It was not a good time in Cumminsville. Everybody's blaming each other, everybody's scared. And investigators even drained a nearby canal hoping to find evidence, and nothing was found. The murder remained unsolved. And then October 25th, 1910 comes around, and Mary Hackney, 26 years old, and her husband Harley were renting a house overlooking Mill Creek. Harley and a boarder, Charles Eckert, left before dawn to work at a lumber yard. A neighbor saw Mary alive around 7 a.m. A milk boy came by that morning, though, and when he knocked on the door, no one answered, and the door was locked. Harley and Charles returned around noon from work, and the door was still closed and locked. They couldn't get in. So they forced it open, and they discovered Mary lying in the front room with her throat cut and her head crushed. An axe with blood and hair lay nearby. Nothing else in the house was disturbed, and there was no sign of robbery or sexual assault. Police immediately, though, arrested Harley and Charles Eckert, but they ended up having to release them for lack of evidence. Another boarder, Herman Schuring, was also questioned and released. investigators found a bloody thumbprint on the doorframe, but they could not identify it. Some were speculating that Mary's murder was a domestic killing, somebody in the house, but it was disguised as work of this Cumminsville Ripper. Regardless, no arrests were ever made. These two murders, Mary's and Anna Lloyd's, actually inspired the community to get involved, become more active. Women marched on the mayor's office and demanded more streetlights and more police for Cumminsville. And the Susan B. Anthony Club petitioned the public safety director to appoint women detectives. I was debating saying this next part until after I went over suspects and theories, but I don't want this to get more confusing than it needs to be. So in my opinion, Mary Hackney and Anna Lloyd, I do not believe they were killed by the same person that murdered those women in 1904. The MO, the scenarios, basically everything about them is just very, very different. I'm not the only person with this opinion. If you research these cases, you will come across this quite often. However, I could be wrong. And since these murders are often grouped together, I'm going to proceed into the theories and suspects as if they were killed by the same person. Survivors of the 1904 attacks generally agree that the assailant was short, stocky, and wore a dark slouch hat. However, there was no consensus on race. Some described him as white, others black, others mixed. So the first person to talk about as a potential suspect is Charles Stagman, who walked Mary McDonald to her train. He made inconsistent statements. It was kind of an odd situation, but he was released. He was also not seen with Mary when a train operator saw her drunkenly leaning against a phone or telegraph pole. There were also Theodore Salmon and William Wilson, who were arrested for Lulu Mueller's case. Charges were dropped because of lack of evidence, and we haven't come across anything that even remotely ties them to any of the other victims. There's Frank Eastman, who was Lulu's sweetheart, and he was questioned, but he seemed to have alibis. There were three men arrested after Anna Lloyd's murder, but again, there wasn't enough there to send them to trial or anything else. And there were boarders in Mary Hackney's house. Again, not enough evidence to do anything with them. I wanted to go over that list because when you're listening to this tale, you might think of some of these people as being persons of interest, and you should. That's a very valid thing, but none of them fit the descriptions of the short, stocky, slouch hat man. All of them only have connections to the person they know that was the victim. None of them have connections to any of the other victims whatsoever. And that's one of the hardest parts of this case. There is no good suspect. Some theories, though, is that the killer could have been a railroad worker or a transient because the crimes were clustered near these rail lines, and victims were attacked while walking near train tracks, waiting for trains. And some believe the killer had to have been a railroad worker because of this. I would contend that this is a decent theory. However, the original murders were all pretty close together. So I would also add to this, maybe it even narrows down potential suspects, that if it was a worker for the trains, they spent most of their off time in the Cumminsville area. They knew the spots that would be more secluded. They knew where you could drag the bodies to be out of sight, to be not near streetlights, etc., etc. That also connects to the next theory, which is that it had to be a local resident because the killer definitely knew the area so, so well. Many people also bring up a connection to the Dayton Strangler, and that's how I came across the story in the first place. Some speculate and theorize that there's a link between these two. However, there's no evidence to support this. The Dayton Strangler was a serial murderer who killed people between 1900 and 1909 in, of course, Dayton, Ohio, which is not far from Cincinnati, so there's some plausibility here. However, the MO is very different. The attacks are very different. And that's it in terms of theories and suspects, sadly. And one of the very difficult things about this story that I believe would have affected the investigation as well is that information was so sensationalized in the papers. Sensationalism, obviously isn't anything new. We still see it today, but the inconsistency in the details, including just the names of witnesses or persons of interest, like newspapers just couldn't get them right. Even Mary McDonald, her age is often quoted as 32, but she could have been as old as 40. She could have been in her 20s. There are just so many inconsistencies. And even though we're reading that mainly through the press, I guarantee that kind of information was also making it very difficult on detectives in these cases as well. There were also so many stories from residents being told to papers and to authorities of people seeing this slouch hat man. And most of those stories you have to take with a grain of salt because of the frenzy that was going on in this neighborhood. For all we know, the killer never had a slouch hat. It very well might have just been something that started with Mrs. Wheeler when she thought she was being followed by a man with a slouch hat, and then that just kind of spread on from there. So whether a single serial killer prowled the foggy railroads of Cumminsville in 1904, or multiple killers exploited the same dark streets, the deaths of Mary McDonald, Lulu Mueller, Alma Steinweg, Anna Lloyd, and Mary Hackney left a profound impact on Cincinnati.
You've just listened to A Study of Strange. Consider helping us keep the lantern lit, illuminating the unexplained, by subscribing to our Substack. Just head to the support tab at astudyofstrange.com. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with leafy greens and good intentions, only to have our future self sacrifice quality nutrition for the convenience of takeout. Keep your body and mind nourished all day with a whole body meal shake from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. But the best part? It actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you've got endless ways to personalize your Kachava. Whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee, with every 2 scoops of Kachava, you're getting 85 plus superfoods, nutrients, and plant-based ingredients. Your future self will thank you. Go to kachava.com and use code Pandora for 15% off your next order. That's Kachava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code Pandora for 15% off.